Good morning. You are listening to WYSO in Yellow Springs. We have the Book Nook coming up for you. I'm Vic McCunis, and today another guest from the past. We'll have Ted Rawl, who's been on the program a number of times. He grew up in Dayton, Ohio. He's known best as a political cartoonist. He's also a writer, a pundit, and seems to enjoy being involved in various controversies. His current work is Snowden, a biography of Edward Snowden, the man who leaked those confidential files a couple of years ago from the National Security Agency. We'll be talking to Ted Rawl, but first, National Public Radio News. Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome back to the program today Ted Rawl. He joins us by telephone from somewhere in Gotham. Hello, Ted.
Hi, Vic. How are you?
I'm okay. Ted, you've got this new book out. Dare I call this a biography?
It is a biography.
Okay. And it's a graphic biography. It's in the graphic novel form, but it's nonfiction. It's a biography of a guy named Snowden. Now, I think most of us have heard of Snowden, and a lot of people don't like this guy. Why did you decide to write about him?
Well, I actually think his polls are probably running a little higher than Hillary Clinton's right now. But he's it wasn't my idea. My publisher brought it to me, and he said, hey, how about a book about Snowden? And I was, he's a very smart guy, and my publisher, that is, and Snowden as well. And I thought, what a great idea. I just thought, I've heard a lot, an amazing number of fairly well-informed younger adults, it's only been 2 years since Edward Snowden stepped forward, and they don't even know who he is or what he had to say, or they just have some vague idea of what the NSA is up to. And so I thought, what's needed is almost a YA book. A young adult book that lays out exactly what it is that the NSA is up to, and sets out the decision that Snowden had to make. I mean, he was a guy who was trapped between two competing promises, and he couldn't keep both. One of those promises was to keep classified information classified and to not release it to anyone. And the people who don't like Edward Snowden are the people who think that he shouldn't have broken that oath. And he did break that oath. But he also had sworn to defend and protect the Constitution of the United States. And he discovered while working for CIA and NSA contractors that the United States was breaking the law, and not just doing so a little bit, but doing so on a grand, vast scale, the likes of which most Americans just couldn't comprehend. And so he had several choices about how to proceed, but he first considered working within the system and becoming a whistleblower, but he had to quickly set that aside because of the fact that he's not protected by any whistleblower protection laws. He was a contractor. He didn't work for the government directly. So if he had stepped forward and gone to Congress, for example, nothing would have happened there, and he probably would have been, or he certainly would have faced legal jeopardy. So he had, and he also looked at the history of previous whistleblowers like Daniel Ellsberg and Chelsea Manning and people like that, Thomas Drake, the NSA whistleblower from the early 2000s, trying to see if they offered any kind of instruction as to what to do and what not to do. And what he saw was that the U.S. government talks a lot about how whistleblowers are protected, but in reality, they prosecute them. They try to throw them in prison for a very long time. They're not really interested in getting in cleaning up wrongdoing. So Snowden decided that his oath to protect the Constitution was more important than his oath to his employer under his employment contract. Now, that's a debatable point, and we can get into that. But I think in terms of why people don't like him, I think it depends on what do you think is more important, the big issue or the smaller issue. I mean, to me, your promise to your employer is certainly something you should take seriously, but I think the broader point of discovering that your own government is engaged in massive lawbreaking is a far broader, more important point. And if you have to choose between the two, it's pretty clear which one you should pick.
Ted, hearing you talk about him seeing that you've written about him and you want people to know about him, one gets a sense that in a way you might feel like you're sort of a kindred spirit with him.
Well, I think when we assess people's actions, we always put ourselves in that position and say, well, what would I do in this position? So, you know, if you might have a little more sympathy, for example, for the $50,000 a year police officer who breaks into a drug den and finds millions of dollars in cash and keeps $100,000 for himself so he can send his child to college, because you might do that. You might not, but you might, or you might think about doing it, but you might not. But on the other hand, most people would have no sympathy whatsoever for someone who molests children because they can't imagine themselves doing that under any circumstance. Well, I can imagine myself doing what Edward Snowden did if I were ever in that position, which is a huge caveat. I don't think I ever would have been in such a position to have access to so much classified data, because they're not looking for rebels like me at CIA and NSA. They're looking for conformists. And Edward Snowden was a conformist for a long time. And so it was his political transformation that made him change and become someone who would break the law and become a whistleblower. Now, that's something I can imagine myself doing. I like to think that that I know how to pick the big issues over the little issues. And I've never met Edward. I'd like to, but he definitely seems like the kind of person whose mind works in a way similar to mine.
Ted Rawl joins us. His biography, Snowden, has just been published, and he joins us by cell phone in New York City. And it sounds like a train's going by or something.
Nah, no train.
Oh, okay.
I'm in the middle of a Columbia University campus.
Oh, wow. Okay. Beautiful campus. Lots of monuments.
Yeah. Very.
Ted, we look at Snowden through your eyes in this biography. You go back and you talk about how he had a pretty blasé childhood, not a whole lot going on there. He was a typical kid of his generation. He liked playing computer games and fantasy games. And then his parents got divorced when he was just a few years out of high school. And his security blanket kind of got pulled off. At least we get that implication from the way that you describe it.
Yeah, well, I'm a child of divorce myself. It's a very common experience for Americans, especially of a certain age. I get the sense that when his parents' marriage fell apart, it just sort of made him a little bit more cynical. Snowden himself says that there was no one thing that made him decide to go to become a whistleblower, and I believe that. I think there were a lot of incremental incidents and developments in his life that brought him to that place. But he had an unorthodox upbringing in some ways. He got mono when he was in high school, and was forced to drop out, and he ended up getting a GED. This guy who had top access as a systems administrator to the most classified information in the American intelligence community databases never graduated from college. He only has a couple of years of community college. He doesn't have a formal high school degree. He's largely self-taught. So we're talking about a guy who's a little bit of an outsider from day one, you know, big-time computer geek, as you mentioned, college dropout, high school dropout, but of course he does have a high school GED, but still, he didn't go the usual route, and he was very, and then his parents got divorced, and he was kind of lost and drifting, and he kind of floated into the intelligence community just by virtue of where he was living in the D.C. suburbs of Maryland, right near the NSA, just a few miles away, where most jobs are either directly related to NSA or are indirectly related through various subcontractors. Almost everyone's working in the intelligence community or knows someone who is. And his parents were both government employees. So just out of sheer passivity, he ended up at an outfit called CASL, C-A-S-L, which was a linguistics intelligence analysis outfit, part of the U.S. intelligence community. And he worked the desk. He worked the desk. He was the guy who checked your ID when you came through the door. And they discovered that he was smart. And they started promoting him and sending him to training programs. And that's why he was in the position to do what he did when he was 29.
But before he did that, he had a little turn about a dozen years ago when we invaded Iraq. He wanted to become an elite forces member, but he just couldn't cut it.
Yeah, he went to basic training. He broke both of his feet in a training accident. And apparently, if I ever meet him, I'm going to ask to see his feet, or at least hope that he wears sandals, because he talks about how his feet are weird and big. So apparently his weird big feet both shattered during a training exercise. And it's unclear exactly what that training exercise was. But yeah, he wanted to join Special Forces, and he wanted to go to Iraq and help fight Saddam. That tells you something about his politics in 2003. And obviously it's unfair to say that he's become a leftist. I don't think that's true. I think what he really is a libertarian who was kind of a right libertarian, who's more of a center-left libertarian now.
You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. Ted Rall joins us on the program today. His new graphic biography of Snowden just published. And we'll continue with our conversation with Ted Rall right after this. Continuing with the Book Nook on WYSO, Ted Rall joins us. His book is Snowden. It's a biography of Edward Snowden, the man who leaked those documents a couple of years ago. And we were talking about how he took this circuitous route to becoming a whistleblower. After he went into working for these top secret organizations, he moved up quickly. He really got up there in the organization, and it sounds like from reading your biography that when he got transferred to Geneva, that was when he kind of started changing his worldview a little bit.
Yeah, as with a lot of Americans who travel for the first time overseas, for Snowden, being stationed in Geneva, Switzerland, really opened up his eyes to the fact that there are other ways, other cultures, and that America isn't the only most and the only important country on earth and the only important culture. So when he was there, he met people from all over, and he also interacted with members of the intelligence community, CIA agents who were stationed at the consulate there. He was influenced in particular, he says, by one incident that seems to be pretty much run-of-the-mill spycraft, but it really angered him. The U.S. government was very interested in gaining access to a particular bank account in Geneva and the records therein. So they engaged the CIA to turn a Swiss banker who they had asked for these files but had refused to turn them over because they were personal and confidential. So what they did is the CIA guys got the banker drunk and then arranged to have him arrested by the local police for DUI. Then the CIA guys showed up as spontaneous rescuers, got him off the hook so that he owed them. And after that, he agreed to turn over the documents. Pretty standard stuff to anyone who's ever read a John le Carré or a Frederick Forsyth novel is familiar with this sort of thing, not that big a deal. But it struck Edward as a really unfair, low thing to do beneath what the United States should be doing. He felt sorry for the banker. And that seems to be the point at which things really started to flip for him, where he started to see that the United States was not always a force for pure good in the world. And he started paying more attention to what he was seeing on his screen. He saw drone assassinations in real time on computer monitors. He saw lots of classified information that indicated a mass surveillance and all sorts of skullduggery, support for horrible dictators in third world countries, and so on, that made him think that something really needed to be done and something needed to change. But he decided to hold his fire really until the 2008 election, when he saw that President Obama, who had promised major reforms, and particularly of the NSA and its spying against ordinary Americans who had no ties whatsoever to terrorism, he decided to give Obama a chance to carry out his reforms. So he waited. When Obama took office, he waited a few years just to see what he would do. And he didn't. And it was only when he became convinced that Obama was not going to do what he not going to keep his promises vis-a-vis the NSA, that he decided to release all those documents to the Guardian and other newspapers.
And after Snowden leaked those documents, I think most of us recall President Obama's reaction.
29-year-old hacker. That's what he said. It's like, we're not going to let a 29-year-old hacker get us down. But he was 29, and I guess you could say he was a hacker, but he was a lot more. This was an attempt to diminish a guy who the intelligence community itself had trusted implicitly and had taken very seriously and was paying extremely well. This guy was making in the low hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, 29 years old, had an amazing post stationed in Honolulu. He had it all. You know, he had a great girlfriend. He was smart. He was living in a nice house. He had a great, nice salary, nice lifestyle. So, you know, this wasn't a loser in his parents' basement, like popping zits way into the night. This was a highly accomplished young man whom the United States had placed a lot of trust in.
Ted Rall joins us. His book, Snowden, has just come out. And Ted is coming back to his former town. Ted grew up in Kettering. He'll be in our area this coming Wednesday for a book signing at Books and Company at the Green. That's at 7 o'clock on Wednesday evening. He'll be talking about Edward Snowden and his book, Snowden. Reading this book, Ted, it made me glad that I'm such a Luddite, because I don't have a smartphone, and after reading your book, I'm kind of glad, because according to your book, they can track my movements and listen to my conversations on my smartphone, even if it's turned off.
Even if the power is completely gone. Yeah, they can track your movements. They can turn on your phone remotely and monitor monitor both the sound and the video. They can turn on your laptop or your desktop computer's camera, even if the computer is off, and see what's going on in the room. And in fact, there are reports that, and I think they've been pretty much confirmed, that NSA staffers like to do this for fun when they're bored and turn on people's cameras and watch them having sex and then share the tapes with each other. That's your government, folks. Your tax dollars at work.
And the smart TVs, they can do the same thing with those. This is so Orwellian.
Yeah, smart TVs, which are basically, if you buy a new TV now and you just go into Best Buy or whatever, the odds are you'll come away with a smart TV, which is a TV that allows you to have apps like Netflix preloaded on the screen and gain access to YouTube and so on directly through your TV instead of having to have a separate connection. These smart TVs also can be turned into what readers of Orwell's 1984 will recognize as a telescreen, a TV that watches you while you're watching it. It is as Orwellian as it gets.
Why hasn't there been more outrage about Snowden's revelations?
You know, that is a mystery to me. I know that Snowden himself felt that his role was to inform the public and let the public decide whether they cared and if they cared to pressure public officials for change. And he felt that after he took the risks that he took and paid the price that he paid, having to live in exile in Russia, that it was up to us to pick up the ball and keep running with it. But we haven't. It's been 2 years. This is not in the news. No one really cares. It seems that the American people are tacitly compliant and willing to just passively allow this to keep happening. To me, it's a mystery. I mean, when I think, I'm 52 years old, when I think of my memories of the Watergate era and the outrage that followed the news that Richard Nixon had tapped the telephones of just over 100 people who were enemies of the White House, and people were just appalled at the privacy violations at that time. And here you're talking about the NSA is literally recording every phone call you make and storing it so that it can be listened to later should they feel like it. They are scanning every letter and every package and storing that information. They are tracking every single phone call you make so that they know who you're calling, when, and how long. They are reading every email that you've ever sent, every text message. They even know what you're streaming on Netflix. The level, and it's everybody. It's not 90% of the public. It's everyone on Earth. It's everyone all the time. And the fact is that people have this attitude that if they're not doing anything wrong, then they have nothing to fear. And I know from personal experience that that's not true. Governance surveillance can be used against you, and it can be manipulated in a way that that can be used against you even when you haven't done anything wrong. Even if you're not talking to ISIS, it can still be used against you. So I think it is shocking to me. I mean, I think if this sort of thing had come out in the 1980s or 1990s, it would have been completely a non-political issue. Democrats and Republicans alike would have been absolutely disgusted. In fact, I think people on the right would have been more angry at the privacy violations than people on the left even. But everyone would have been appalled. And the only, and this is just, I'm just speculating here because I really can't put myself in the mindset of the people who don't care. But I'm guessing that it has a lot to do with all those years of giving away our privacy voluntarily to companies like Twitter and Facebook every time we open an account. And we sign these 54-page terms and conditions things that nobody reads because, after all, if you want to be part of the world, you have to be part of these social networks. And people just know that their social security numbers are compromised. They know that everything's hacked. I think they probably just feel that the horse is out of the barn, long gone. It's too late to close the doors, or you can, but it won't do any good. That's the best I can think, but it's not the way I think. I mean, I personally think it's appalling, and a lot of people agree with me. A lot of Americans agree with me. Certainly people overseas agree, because in Europe, there's been a huge outcry over the Snowden revelations to the point where the European Union is spending billions of dollars to build an alternative cloud, a Euro cloud, as an alternative to the Google-managed old cloud 1.0, to the fact that a lot of companies will no longer do business with American companies, and the American economy has been deprived of billions, if not trillions, of dollars of business from foreign industries that are afraid of NSA and other surveillance that could be used for industrial espionage that would hurt them. So there's obviously a huge amount of concern, and there's been some reaction on the private front here. For example, the iPhone 6 and the iPhone 6 Plus are both encrypted and safe from the NSA. In other words, they are dark to NSA. They offer point-to-point encryption that makes it not possible for the NSA to survey your communications on those phones. And then there's also new apps that are available, some of which are free, that allow you to do point-to-point digital encryption on text messaging and phone calls. For example, one is called Signal, and I use that one. And that one's, you know, Snowden approved. So there's a lot of, the private business seems to be responding to the fact that there is a real demand for privacy. People do, and it's not people doing bad things. It's not people on Ashley Madison. It's ordinary folks just like you and me who just don't want the government in our business.
Tad, are you using an iPhone 6 right now?
Sadly, I can't afford one.
Okay.
I have a 5S.
But you're using Signal. You're on Signal, right?
I'm not on Signal. The message the reception would actually be worse if we were talking on Signal.
Okay, so
you need a really, really strong, like, 4 bars.
The NSA is listening right now. Ted, I got to go.
Okay.
Just kidding.
That's reasonable.
Ted Rall joins us. His book is Snowden. And Ted will be in Dayton for a book signing this week, Wednesday, September 9th, 7 p.m., Books & Company at the Green, 4453 Walnut Street in Beaver Creek. Ted grew up in Kettering, and we've had him on the program a number of times over the years. Ted, a little bit earlier, you were starting to talk about the NSA, and it was coming out of your mouth, and I realized now this guy's so used to talking about something else that something else came out of his mouth for a second. Instead of NSA, you said LA, and then you changed. Now, Ted,
yeah.
Now why would you do that?
Well, I've been talking a lot about what happened to me at the LA Times a month ago.
Right. I know you have. Okay. I wasn't sure if it was.
I'm supposed to run with it now. Okay,
It was LA Times or LAPD that you were trying to say.
Well, is there a difference at this point? Okay, so here's what happened. I've been drawing cartoons on California and Los Angeles issues for the LA Times for the last 6 years, since 2009. And with those cartoons for the last probably 3 years or so, I've been submitting a blog that goes with the online edition of the cartoon that explains the inspiration for the cartoon and the background of the story that it's based upon, because sometimes you see a cartoon and you're like, what's he talking about? I didn't read that article. So it kind of helps explain that. And it's a popular feature. But so anyway, in May of this year, the LAPD announced that they were going to do a crackdown against illegal jaywalking in the city of Los Angeles. And this reminded me of an incident of my own 14 years prior in October of 2001, I was arrested for jaywalking and handcuffed and given an expensive summons, misdemeanor offense for jaywalking in the West Hollywood section of L.A. When I was on my way to dinner after filming a TV show, I was on Bill Maher's Politically Incorrect. And that incident I wrote about as the first 3 or 4 paragraphs of my blog from May 11th, and just to sort of go over what it was that, just to sort of put a personal angle on something that on this jaywalking story. So I talked about how the cop had grabbed me off the street, even though I had not jaywalked. I was completely innocent for once of jaywalking. And he grabbed me and threw me up against a wall, and then he handcuffed me, and while I was waiting there, just left me there, and then wrote the ticket. And then at the end of, after he released me and gave me the ticket, he said, okay, well, here's your license back. But instead of handing it back to me, he threw it on the ground and left. That's the short version of the story. So at the time, I was so angered primarily by the fact that, well, he'd been a rude jerk, and also by the fact that he obviously had a quota to fill, and he just picked me. I wasn't guilty. And I was just really angry about it. So I filed a complaint with the Department of Internal Affairs, nothing came of it. They blew me off and didn't talk to me and said that on their own they had come to the conclusion that it was groundless. And that was that. So all these So years passed, and my piece came out in May, and a reporter from the LA Times, whose name is Paul Pringle, called me and informed me that LAPD was challenging my version of events and saying that I had lied, that in fact I had never been handcuffed or thrown against a wall, and in fact this police officer never in his 20-year career on the force had ever used handcuffs at all, and that there had never been a crowd that had gathered and yelled at the police officer as I described in my piece, and that he had never thrown my license on the ground, and then he informed me that the cop had surreptitiously recorded this incident on audio tape, not video, audio tape, and that they had the tape, and that it backed up the LAPD's version of events of a polite encounter, not mine, of a brusque encounter with an out-of-control cop. So I was really, of course, surprised, and upon listening to the tape, appalled that they even bothered me with this, because what there was on the tape was it was 6 minutes and 20 seconds long, about 20 seconds of, you can hear a little bit of the cop talking about where he is, and that's about it. And then the rest of it is all just static and road noise. It's literally like, and I've listened to it. I couldn't count how many times. There's just nothing on it, you know? I mean, it's worthless. So, you know, Pringle was on the phone while I was listening to it, and he's like, well? And I'm like, well, what? He's like, well, what do you think? And I'm like, I don't think about it. I was like, this is a joke. This is a effing joke, is what I said. This is just there's nothing on this. And he says, well, this doesn't, why can't we hear your driver's license being thrown to the ground? And I said, because we're on Earth and driver's licenses are made of paper. How on earth are you going to hear that? And I said, besides which, this isn't exactly Steven Spielberg's boom mic. This is a really crappy tape made with a crappy audio cassette, micro cassette from 2001 that has since been dubbed to something and been compressed into a digital wave file. So it's just a total, it's a kind of evidence that says nothing. It's, even if you had a clear video, I mean, a clear audio of this incident, you wouldn't have, you know, this is not going to allow you to see him to throw me against the wall. You're not going to see him. You're not going to see him handcuff me. You're not going to see him throw my license to the ground. And he knows he's being recorded. So, one thing you can hear on the tape is him whistling every now and then. Well, turns out that we found out why he was whistling. So anyway, the point, to make a long story short, LA Times believed the LAPD, took them at their word, even though they had a clear political agenda here. I mean, I had been drawing anti-LAPD cartoons for years. They hated me. And this evidence is non-existent. I mean, an audio tape isn't even admissible in court unless it's the original, and this is not the original. So we don't know how badly the tape was spliced or tamped down or otherwise manipulated, but it almost certainly was, and we're working on that now. But the point is, the Times really didn't launch a very careful investigation. They literally called me on a Thursday night and by Friday afternoon decided to fire me. I never got a chance to talk to the editorial board. I never got a chance to tell my side of the story to my colleagues or to confront the police or anything. And they just gave me the bum's rush out. And then to add insult to injury, they posted an editor's note in the print edition and online, which you can still find if you Google a note to readers at my name, Ted Rall, you'll find it. And it says that I'm a liar and a fabulist. That's what it says. In so many words, there's no escaping the message. Hmm. I mean, it's the kind of message that newspapers print when they want you to never work again. They don't always even do it for cases of plagiarism. And just to put this into perspective, they wouldn't do it even if I were guilty of something like this, even if I had pulled Brian Williams on this story. That still would not have happened. But anyway, the editor's note came out on a Tuesday, July 28th. And on July 29th, the next day, a lot of my readers saw the editor's note and asked me to email them the audio file because they were audio experts and wanted to see if they could sort of use a little CSI magic to clean it up. And on Thursday morning, I woke up and in my inbox was, in fact, a short bit of cleaned up tape where you can hear a woman shouting at the police officer, and she's saying, "Take off his handcuffs." And she says it several times. Mm-hmm. And so I sent, I was, of course, just ecstatic, because two of the major points that the Times had cited, the discrepancies between my story and their story, were that they said there was never an angry crowd. Well, here's at least an angry woman. And they said that there was that I had not been handcuffed, but I had been. So I Googled the officer's name, and I found a picture. I found a picture of him in an article dated the same week that my blog had come out, where he's with a handcuffed suspect and making fun of him. And it's for a more minor offense than jaywalking is in LA. It's not even a misdemeanor, it's just a traffic stop. And so I was like, what? So I sent all this to my editor, Nick Goldberg at the Times, editorial page editor. He's the guy who fired me. To say, look, you were wrong. I've now been able to prove it. Please give me back my job, issue a retraction, and apologize so we can move on. And there was no answer whatsoever, which I just thought was really weird and creepy, because that's just not the way newspapers are supposed to behave. Newspapers are supposed to, when they come into the possession of new facts, they're supposed to assess them, investigate them, and when they recognize that they've made a mistake, admit it and issue a correction. That's just the normal thing to do. And this is when it started to dawn upon me that maybe there were more sinister forces at work when I didn't get a reply. But so I thought, maybe, okay, what I really need is even more proof. So on that Friday, I hired a company called Post Haste Digital, which is a Hollywood post-production company that works on films, to enhance the tape, as they call it, audio enhancement. And they spent the weekend doing it. I dropped over $1,000 to do it. And they came back with a tape that says that it's the full 6 minutes and 20 seconds enhanced. And it's still missing a lot, because the tape, the original, is so bad, is so low quality. But now suddenly there's a huge new soundscape that became open as a result of this new second tape. This one, now there are 3 to 4 people shouting at the police officer. They're very angry at him. They're even making fun of his lack of masculinity and making sexual insults to him at his expense. He's replying to them to, like, no, to leave him alone. He wants to write me a ticket first. And it's pretty out there. It's pretty out of control. And what it shows is, without a doubt, it shows that the police officer lied when he said he didn't handcuff me or that there wasn't an angry crowd. It certainly doesn't show the driver's license being thrown to the ground, which he couldn't. But hey, yeah, that's an audio tape. And it certainly doesn't. And it basically kind of shows me being handcuffed, in that you can hear the sound of something clicking on at that right time. But you can't really be sure. But the whole point is, it's the tape certainly doesn't clarify everything. It's a little murky, but it clarified in my favor, not in the LAPD's favor. And so I sent that to Nicholas Goldberg and waited for him to reply. Well, he never did. He still hasn't. It's been a month. I'm still waiting to hear from him. And so I put all this stuff on the internet to let the world judge for themselves. And anyone who is interested can go to my website, rawl.com, or go to anewdomain.net. That's anewdomain.net, in order to listen to the two versions of the tape and see a timeline and sort of get a sense of exactly how all this went down. It's kind of like a detective story. It's kind of interesting and it's pretty controversial. But even among the right wing, which doesn't care for my work, there's a general consensus online that I was telling the truth and that the Times reacted poorly and basically fired me as a favor to the LAPD. Now, in the process of this whole thing, the LA Times has gone into lockdown mode. They don't answer questions from reporters. They are refusing to talk to to have any kinds of discussions whatsoever about this. They won't say where they got the tape or what format it's in. They are being anything but transparent. They won't say who received the tape, and they won't talk about some serious conflict of interest allegations that have come up between LAPD and LA Times. I mean, the LA Times is supposed to be an independent newspaper that is free to make the editorial calls that it wants to in the search for truth. But it's disturbing to find that the LAPPL, which is the LAPD police union, has its entire $18 billion pension fund invested in a small Beverly Hills private equity firm called Oak Tree Capital. And that Oak Tree Capital is also the number one shareholder of Tribune Publishing, which is the parent company of the Los Angeles Times. And it's also a little disturbing to find that the LAPPL gave the publisher of the LA Times, Austin Buettner, a special award called the Eagle and Badge Award last year when he had just been appointed publisher just a few months, kind of equivalent to Obama getting the Nobel in his first year. Like, why is the LAPPL sucking up to Austin Buettner so quickly? There's also rumors that Buettner, who's a former deputy mayor, is interested in running, wants to run all of City Hall in L.A., and that he has sought out the LAPPL as his major political ally because he doesn't have much of a popular support base among the electorate of Angelenos. So there's other conflicts of interest, but this is looking like a case of collusion between the LAPD and the LA Times, and it's looking like they got rid of me not because they just needed to fire me. That's really easy. They could just have claimed that they didn't have any more money to carry my cartoons, and that would have been that. They could have told the cops, well, look, we got rid of him. You wanted him gone. He's gone. But it looks more and more like it was done in order to send a message to other journalists not to mess with the LAPD. And in fact, the LAPPL even published a blog in the immediate aftermath of my firing saying LAPPL applauds the firing of cartoonist Ted Rall by the LA Times, and that the LAPPL within there claims that they say they warn other journalists that and other press organizations that they should be careful lest the same thing happens to them. It gets deeper. I mean, the LAPPL is the same police union pension fund that in 2009 used its pension funds to purchase stock in the parent company of the newspaper in San Diego, the Union Tribune. They bought, and when they did that, they issued a statement in, of all places, the LA Times, saying that now that they quote unquote owned the newspaper, they have the right to hire and fire any opinion maker on the opinion pages. There's mixed reports as to whether or not they actually did get to fire any members of the editorial board in San Diego. Mm. But certainly they wanted to, and they said that was their interest. I mean, certainly you don't buy print newspaper stock if you're looking for a good investment in 2009 or 2015. I mean, print media is dying. Tribune Publishing is a very poorly performing stock. The only reason you buy it is for the political influence that they say that they're looking to exercise, and it looks like they exercised it in this case.
Ted, I'm sorry to interrupt you. We went way past our break there because I knew the second I said L.A., I knew that was going to happen, Ted. It's my I did it. We've been joined by a guy. They call him a liar. They call him a fabulous. Some people say he's incredibly annoying. Ted Rall, we'll be right back right after this. You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO, and I just made the mistake of asking Ted Rawl about Los Angeles. Sorry about that, Ted. I know that you're
well,
just...
No, I'm glad you made that mistake. These guys have smeared me, and they're a serious threat to freedom of the press in the United States. I don't care if you're a Republican or a Democrat. No one wants the police or a government agency telling a newspaper what to do.
Ted, what is it about you? Didn't you used to have a regular strip in the New York Times? Who did you make mad about that one?
No, I never had a regular strip.
Oh, okay, but you used to. I used to see you in there all the time, Ted.
I used to be in the New York Times a lot, but nobody's in the New York Times anymore except for one guy, Brian McFadden. They used to have a lot of different cartoons, and then they got rid of a lot of them during the cheap old days of the mid 2000s. And that's more of an economic thing. They just didn't want to pay for them anymore, and they picked a fight with the editorial cartoonists. They asked us all to start submitting our work and hoping that we might get reprinted instead of just sending them reprint work and having them buy the ones that they wanted. So that's kind of what happened. The New York Times tried to, they just didn't want to pay for our work anymore. They wanted to get it for free.
Ted, what's it like for being a political cartoonist these days? How's the world looking for you?
Well, it's still it's still a great, fun, exciting, interesting job. It's not possible to draw the perfect political cartoon, so it's always challenging, and I think I will always love it. The problem is that the economics are tough, just as they are for all of print media, but cartoonists have gotten hit particularly hard because our work tends to be controversial. It tends to ruffle feathers in powerful places, and so a lot of newspapers tend to print very bland content. They're not taking any chances. This is actually ironic because the newspapers that publish edgier work are the ones that actually have higher circulation. The ones that are bland are doing exceptionally poorly. Playing it safe is a way to commit suicide when you're a newspaper. Play wild and crazy and you're going to get some readers. Mm. But most newspaper editors and publishers just don't seem to understand the basic economics of their own business. And they fired all the smart people. So the political cartoons are very popular where they appear, but a lot of as part of the drive to make the newspaper as boring as possible, they're getting rid of them. So it's tough to make it. I mean, I like to think that I'm doing better than most, and people can argue about why that is. I think it's because people like content that makes them think and not necessarily just makes them feel comfortable. So I would say I'm liking the job, and I look forward to doing it for many years to come, but the profession is in deep, deep trouble, and I don't know that there will be anyone doing this at all within 10 years.
Ted Rawl joins us. We've been talking about his new book, Snowden, and some other things. And you can meet Ted. He will be in the Dayton area this Wednesday, September 9th at 7 o'clock. He'll be at Books and Company talking about his new biography of Edward Snowden. And that's at the Green, 4453 Walnut Street, Beaver Creek. Okay, we have just enough time, Ted, to talk about your boyhood in Dayton, Ohio. What was it like?
Well, I grew up in Kettering, went to George L. Ernst Elementary, Dorothy Lane Elementary School in Kettering, then George L. Ernst, then Barnes Junior High School, then high school at Fairmont West, now Fairmont High School. I lived in a Huber home. Very typical childhood, I think. Single mother, it's just me and her. And it was kind of tough, kind of challenging economically. She was a school teacher, so we're not always, and back then she wasn't making much money. I remember she started at like $8,500 a year, and we weren't always sure where the next meal was coming from. But it was in many ways a great place to grow up because it was relatively safe. It certainly wasn't like growing up in New York City. And it was very, very, very calming place. But I think now it's culturally come a long way. I mean, I would have loved there to have been a store like Books & Co. when I was a kid, and there wasn't. There's much more of a cultural scene in Dayton than there was. It was definitely kind of boring growing up in Kettering, but it's where I'm from. It'll always be home.
My guest has been Ted Rall. His new book is Snowden, and it just came out, and he will be in town. He'll be at Books & Company this Wednesday, September 9th at 7 o'clock for book signing. That's 4453 Walnut Street in Beaver Creek. And Ted, we've had you on the show a number of times over the years, and it's always a great thing to talk to you again.
Likewise, Vic, and I apologize for the cell phone.
No worries, Ted. And if the NSA calls you after this call is completed, tell them that you don't know me. That we were just—I was a telemarketer, and we don't
That's
know.
Right. Know
we,
who?
We don't know each other. We've never met. Okay.
I don't even know anyone.
Very good, Ted. Well, thank you so much.
You too. Take care.
You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. My guest has been Ted Rall. His new book is Snowden. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McKeonis. Thanks for listening. Tune in for The Book Nook on Sunday morning at 10:30. My guest will be Anna Bodkin. She's the author of an extraordinary book called Walking with Abel, Journeys with the Nomads of the African Savannah. That's The Book Nook on WYSO.